Let's do a little review. We got quite into this bit last time of trans-subjective and trans-psychic. That was on page 53. That's pretty much where we stopped, on page 54. Try to recap that simply. Just because you dream of God doesn't mean God exists. That's putting it in a nutshell. In other words, the dream of God would be a part of the psyche that is God-like, but we'll be talking at great length what that means, that it's really not part of your ego, it's part of your psyche, so that it's a psychic part of you, but it doesn't mean that it's trans-psychic, that something exists beyond the psyche, that there is a God somewhere. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. So that was the whole point of that. And we'll pursue that a lot more. There's issue that's going to come up that the book will be following along. Where do the contents that are projected reside? Freud would say, well, they're all internal parts of you that you've repressed from your personal experience. Jung is going to say something else. And so that, in a way, is the subject matter of the book. We're talking a little bit here about what is it that is projected. I'm just putting the question. We'll be following that up as we go along. So, in other words, you can dream of God. It doesn't mean there's a God. God is trans-psyche. God is trans-objective, but it's not necessarily trans-psyche. Maybe he is, maybe he is. One of the difficult things about this chapter, just to put a little parenthesis for a second, is what in the world are you supposed to do with it? I thought it was, of all the chapters in the book, the most theoretical or even obtuse. I can tell you what it means to me, and as we go along, you might want to be thinking, what's it mean to me? And maybe that's something we can discuss. She's going to be talking about the role of understanding in science. And she'll have a couple of theses, and I brought along Pally's work, too, because she and Pally were working on this together. I think in some places he said it a little more fully. We think of science as objective, but what they are working with is no, its verification is objective, but the creative process is subjective. That is to say, it starts in an image. If you look in the dreams of scientists as they are coming up with their idea, it first starts as an image. Now, the reason there's not been much published about that is because no scientists have done that. Pally did that. And that's really where it came from, that he could see his ideas began as dream images. So it opens up science to a whole new vista. One, you can interpret scientific achievements psychologically if you know the images that accompany them. So we have normally thought, well, we can interpret art. But science, oh, that's objective. But with this point of view that she's working with, no, it's not objective. It's objective in its verification. But its origin is highly subjective, and it follows a dream sequence. Or you can watch it in the dreams as it evolves. So that science has a personal meaning for the scientist. Another thing that it means to me is that if there are images that accompany the scientific process, that gives us a way to evaluate with the feeling function what the meaning of that scientific process or that scientific accomplishment is. In other words, today we have the implicit idea, if it's possible, we'll do it. But if we can begin to evaluate from the point of view of the image that underlies science, what the value of that process or discovery or invention is, then we have a way to begin to evaluate. Will this ever make a difference in history? I don't know. But at least they're trying to open this question up again as to the subjectivity of the scientific process for the meaning it has for the individual and for the meaning it might have for the society. Now, those of you who aren't working in science, you might think, well, so what? And then you just have to hold your horses until we get through this chapter. But because that's what she's trying to do, is show the relevance of scientific, of the scientific enterprise to the people who are working in it and to the society at large. There you might be able to plug in. So that's how I have tried to make it personal for myself, but you might want to ask yourself as we're going along, so what, all the time. Yeah.
Jean. Well, a really good example, I think, was just the other day in the newspaper, David Ignatius, you know, the editorial guy, he was talking about drones. And he said, yeah, you know, we've used them, and they've helped evaluation-wise in the Army, anyway, they say it's helped fight terrorists and Al-Qaeda, but... Now we're using it, and maybe indiscriminately, and other countries are also coming up with that technology. So what does that, where is this all leading to?
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the reasons Pakistan hates us so much is the innocent people have been killed by drones. So we don't think about that, that these inventions have a shadow. And that's maybe what the dream would point us to, or the images that accompany it. Yeah, that's a good example.
Well, the atomic bomb.
And the atomic bomb, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll try to make this as practical as possible, this chapter, but be aware that it points at me seem like, so what do I care about what somebody, what a scientist said in the 16th century? But we'll try to bring it down to our personal experience.
It's interesting the links that science goes to make it as objective as possible.
Right.
And I just wonder if they're swinging so far to the other side that it's skewing things.
I'm like sure it is.
By not bringing in the subjective element, like the original image and all of that, and keeping that in mind.
One of the things that Polly will talk about, she doesn't talk about it in here so much, is that, but it's probably self-evident to most of you, originally, science, or pre-sciences, alchemy, was a dual discipline. There was the work in the laboratory, and then the study and the prayer. And they felt those two had to work harmoniously, and Pally felt clearly that one of the reasons science has gotten into such a mess is we separated those two. Now, we can't go back to the old viewpoint that alchemy was based on, but we can say, is there a way to bring our subjectivity into relationship with scientific work to help keep it human?
Could we say that science was born out of a desire to understand God, whatever God is?
That's what she's going to be saying,
okay.
part of what she's saying. She's going to be saying, and probably too, it is motivated by the same search for God, I think.
And yet, now it has become anything but that.
It's detached from its origin. Mm-hmm. So that would be a way to put it too, that what we call science is really meant to be a dual focus process.
Although there definitely are some scientists who work that for them, that order is God. You know, whatever underlying order there is in the universe is God.
So yeah.
For individual scientists.
They are, I think, on the periphery though. And that's a movement that's taken root in the last 50 years. For Joff Capra, well, you know, there's a whole slew of books coming out about the relationship between quantum physics and God. Yeah, I don't think any of them do the question justice personally, because they all work with consciousness. None of them work with the unconscious that I know of anyway. It's like, the Buddhists have this idea, quantum physicists have this idea, see the link. And I don't know if that's going to get to the heart of the problem. I think the heart of the problem is the unconscious response to these issues. Okay, so we left off at 54. Now, she gets to kind of to one of her main theses on two-thirds of the way down to 54. 54. Second paragraph, and then go down about halfway down that second paragraph. Often attempted to keep it alive. See where I am? And include it within the new truth by means of a new interpretation in the natural. So that was what we talked about last time. That, and this I think you'd probably feel more, that what religion has called divine truth, you can either, let's say before Jung, you can either believe it, that's the believer's point of view, or you can say, well, it's just rationalistic. From a rationalistic standpoint, it's just garbage, you know. Nobody ever turned one fish into a thousand. And Jung's point is, and some theologians have picked this up, well, these aren't historical truths. They would say religious truths, or we would say psychological truths. So that we are withdrawing the projection onto religion and finding its inner equivalent. That's what we did last week, hopefully. That makes sense. Now she's taking that idea and extending it to science. In the natural sciences, however, such outdated statements were for the most part simply dropped. They were rationally invalidated in line with the fourth stage, and it did not occur to anyone to ask, where did this error in which we believed for such a long time come from? She's going to go through a bunch of different theories. Just think, for example, pre-scientific revolution, where it was thought the Earth was the center of the universe. That was a model which seemed to fit certain astronomical calculations. We know it's not true anymore. So where did that idea come from? It came from an inner image. And that's a very blatant example. We could also say, take Newton, where Newton thought for every action there is some cause that starts it moving. Well, we know that's not true anymore. In the atom, events occur spontaneously. So we've had to include spontaneity in our universe. So where did the idea come from that everything is understandable by the model of cause and effect? What she's saying is those models were projections. You can see when a theory is outdated how it has a subjective origin. And of course we say, oh, but now our quantum view of the universe is fact. And she probably would say, well, in 200 years would we be saying quantum is kind of true? Well, I take this thing that you sent me, Kathy, with you read in the news that apparently they found particles that go faster than the speed of light. So where did the idea come from that nothing can go faster than the speed of light? I mean, their data could be wrong, but let's suppose the data is right. These things which we held as immutable truths in light of further research are seen to be false. And then science just says, oh, well, they're not true, we'll move on. And Bob Ross is saying, whoa, there's a projection here. Which, if we don't integrate it, will simply find another place to park itself. The implication, you see, is science is a carrier of myth. You only see that when you realize how a previous worldview is debunked in the light of new data.
And if it does happen to be true about the neutrino,
yeah,
then they have to go back and reformulate a lot of their ideas.
Everything.
About the universe.
Probably, yeah. I'd be interested to see how that goes. You know the story about the planet Mercury? Some of you heard me tell that. Do you know that story? just to show you how this stuff evolved, I have my trusty little whiteboard, which I've used once in 10 years. So let's see if I can get this right. There's the sun. Here's the orbit of the planet Mercury. Here's the orbit of the planet Earth. Now, the work of Newton and Kepler, we'll talk about Kepler today, gave us a set of formulas to predict accurately where everything would be. Except for one little moment. When the Earth is here and Mercury was here, the calculations were off just a minuscule amount. Can you all see that? Mm-hmm. We're off just a minuscule amount. And Einstein didn't let that go. What he finally figured out was it actually was where it was calculated to be, but due to the bending of light around the sun, it was in a different place. So that little teensy, minuscule angle of error got Einstein to reevaluate absolutely everything about the universe. And this neutrino stuff might be the same thing. A teensy little fact is going to require everything to be reevaluated. So again, we would say then to Einstein, so where did that idea come from? That light, nothing goes faster than the speed of light. And there would be an image in that. We don't know what that image is, but we'd have to find that out. And that would be as relevant to our psychic truth as any religious image. But we don't do that. That's the point of her chapter. But we should. So she's just contrasting on page 54 this chapter and the last chapter. And she goes back to the last chapter on 55, where she says, the old images of God, see where I am, it's 2, 4, 6, about 8, 10 lines down, are now seen as images of psychological powers. So we talked about that last time. Venus would be love, Mars would be aggression, Mercury would be reason, and so on. And with the death of the Greek pantheon, we can say, well, I have to own up to my own reason. I have to own up to my own aggression. I have to own up. I can't project that anymore. And her point in this chapter is, so we also need to do that with the images that have been the foundation of previous scientific worlds.
I just have a quick little question.
Yeah.
At the bottom of page 54, which talks about mind.
Yes.
In one way, she uses mind to indicate the ego, and then she flips over and uses it to indicate spirit.
She does that. She'll do that with Unus Mundus.
In what respect?
Well, at first she talks about Unus Mundus as if it's just some sort of internal thing, and then she'll talk about it as the relationship between internal and external. That's an intuitive thought process for you. Mm-hmm. But we have to then sort of stop and say, now, which way is she using it here?
Well, I suppose the history of use of the word mind includes both.
Right. Right.
And then you could ask, where does mind exist, too? Is it just internal? Or?
Yes. If you want to get really epistemological. actually, I'm afraid we're going to talk about that coming up near the end of the chapter. Yeah. Yeah, but this is, I think, one of the things that torments people who read her and Jung. They do flip between use of words, and you kind of have to second-guess them.
Jung usually tells us in what respect we're using it, though.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about that in other classes. Originally, mind meant the ability to perceive spirit. And the discussion starts it because in the German, the word for mind and the word for spirit are the same. Geist. And even mental, like in German, if you want to be polite, you say somebody has a geistige Störung, a spiritual disturbance, which means they're crazy. Mm-hmm. So that shows up. But we have reduced the word mind to mean intellect. But originally its meaning was that organ which can perceive spirit. Well, I think that's pretty much 55. she takes a shot at biological research at the bottom of 55. That how these, now in a way, now she's going back to the previous chapter again. These psychological powers have been projected onto the outer world, were projected onto the outer world, aggression and so on that we talked about, aggression, reason, the like, love, aggression, reason, the like, of Venus and Mars and Mercury, etc. And she says, and we're still doing it, but we're trying to find it in the body.
They are doing some new consciousness research that isn't so restricted to those ideas.
Your input has really helped me understand the value of that work. I think what she's driving at, what bothers me is they'll say, well, such and such a process occurs in such and such a part of the brain. Mm-hmm. So?
Well, and also, they're not actually restricting it that way. They're saying, well, when this occurs, this part of the brain is activated, and yet something is going beyond the physical body.
Is it? That second part I haven't heard. I take your word for it. In other words, it confuses where something occurs with the meaning of its occurrence. I think that's what she's driving at.
Right, and they're starting to get away from that.
Are they?
They're connecting the activity of neurons with quantum entanglement, and they're looking at how that might help explain psychic phenomena.
That is interesting.
That's an area of research that's going on.
And what you said about the people who with blind in one eye who respond to stimuli that the eye doesn't see, mm-hmm. I think is very important. So I'm not discounting it. I'm just saying that the tendency to define something's meaning by where it occurs in the body, I think, is very limited. Not everyone does that, but some do that.
Right. I'm just saying that there's some new things going on.
Yeah, that sounds helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I've tried to give you the main outlines, and we'll look at the various pieces. 56. Here is the idea of scientific creativity beginning in imagination. Last paragraph, 2-4 lines down. The intuitive visual pre-stage of what has developed in today's scientific hypotheses or thought models, that's the theme. Because the forms as they become outworn were still not recognized as projections. So she's got two ideas in that sentence. One, that what I, both of which I mentioned, that the scientific process starts in an image, and when we see that the theory is false. Up to now, there's been no real inquiry into what was the image behind that theory, which we are now in a position to integrate. And I thought I'd take a couple of detours here and there and read you where Pauli said the same thing, I think a little more fully, in Adam and Archetype. this is the Pali-Yoga correspondence, which is rough to read, but rich. He wrote an essay on this, which is in this book. And what the essay is about, I'll just hit the very top, is the archetypal background of scientific terms and concepts. And I think the fact that a scientist wrote this, it makes it all the more important. He says that in, so if you're interested in following up, that's on page 180. Repeats that on page 188 and 189. And we're going to be talking about Kepler in a minute. Kepler is the guy who, after Copernicus said that, no, the Earth isn't the center, the Sun's the center, and the Sun revolves around, the Earth revolves around the Sun, he came up with the formulas to describe that motion. So he was really one of the first big scientists. But we'll see his thought process was entirely mythological. Pali stresses that the images behind the scientific work contain the emotions that the scientist needs to reckon with, and that a full knowledge of nature is both rational and emotional. And so by having separated ourselves from the images that underlie our theories, we've separated ourselves from the emotional relationship to nature. That's how we can take a forest, which is what this area was when I moved here, and turn it into a series of strip malls. There is no emotional relationship to our technology and such. As he says, in the first level of understanding, the place of clear concepts is taken by images with strong emotional content, not thought out, but beheld.
What?
Beheld.
Oh.
So that he's acknowledging that scientific understanding is a revelation. In an image form first. A scientist gets a hunch. Here's where I will investigate. That is not rational, says Pali. That's emotional. And in that state of mind, there's an image. Then later it becomes thought out.
That goes back to what the discussion you and Carol are having, because the research that she's talking about comes from different types of research facilities than the research you're talking about. There are some research facilities that are funded by, say, a corporation, and they are, we need to find this kind of a product that is going to fix this kind of a problem.
Good point.
And then there are other research that are funded maybe by a university or a government who they have a mandate to just look at things without a reason or a
good point.
Goal in mind.
Yeah.
And if you watch how funding happens, that funding is much more tenuous, that type of funding. So that's what's driving the differences in.
Yeah, good. Thank you. You also gave me a chance to think of something while you were speaking. A real practical example here would be schizophrenia. I don't think you can find a psychiatrist that won't tell you schizophrenia is an organic disturbance of the brain. End of story. And Jung's position was 112 years ago, yes, there is an organic disturbance of the brain, but it's an effect, not a cause. So by calling it a biological phenomenon, the meaning is stripped of it. And just because there's a biological disturbance doesn't mean there's not a meaning. That's what she was referring to, I think, in that other quote. Now, my favorite quote from Pali. Ta-da! I don't know if it'll... I think I maybe said it before. I don't know if it'll touch you as much as it touched me. I now believe... This is on page 87. I now believe in the simultaneous religious and scientific function of the appearance of archetypal symbols. I think with that sentence, he completely solves the split between science and religion. I now believe in the possibility of a simultaneous religious and scientific function of the appearance of archetypal symbols. What that means to me is we think, well, science is provable knowledge, and religion is knowledge based on faith. Or you might say science is knowledge based on reason, and religion is science based on faith. But if we understand that the scientific process starts in an image, just like the religious revelation is an image, there's no more conflict. The problem is that we take religion as something to worship rather than an image to fulfill. In other words, in that image, you're given your work to do in life, say. And same thing with science. There are different modes than a verification, but the original experience is exactly the same.
Did he use the word beheld? That has an awe quality
to
it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think that's an interesting choice of word.
Yes. And I'm sure a very conscious one. Mm-hmm. So that's Pali's addition to the intuitive visual pre-stage. I think that's just so important.
And that, in a way, brings back that whole alchemical attitude towards the work.
Absolutely. It sure does. But in a way that isn't superstitious.
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier something... at how you put the question about the search for God in science. And, you know, I think today we're laboring under, you know, the effect of so much technology that we forget what technology has accomplished and what science. We don't have witch hunts anymore. We don't have polio. So we have to remember that search for verifiable knowledge had an incredibly important role in our mental development. You couldn't have a discussion about withdrawing projections if you didn't have an ego that respected reason. So the problem, though, has gotten we've swung so far. And what von Braun's saying, Pali with her, is, okay, let's get back to that original unity without the superstition. Okay, happy so far.
I just think it's interesting that even in religion, we've lost the connection to feeling and evaluation of what's really good for humans.
Absolutely.
I mean,
originally that was what its purpose was, that being, you know, that now the fundamentalists and the extremists are, you know, it's so out of touch with, is that really helping us as a human race or hurting, or even religion is.
Yeah, fundamentalism also cuts out the feeling evaluation because it doesn't admit there's a projection. And we've seen in the latter stage of withdrawing the projection, a feeling evaluation has to take place. In the later stages of withdrawing projection, a feeling evaluation of what has been projected has taken place.
And so, I mean, you know, today religion is even as bad as an offender.
Or
in,
worse.
In that, as science, in that state of non-feeling.
As is the purely so-called scientific standpoint, which admits no validity to feeling, because it's not verifiable, not seeing that that feeling process started the whole inquiry to begin with. Yes, indeed. And what Jung did was simply look at some of those Christian stories and feel about them. Look what he did to the book of Job. Everyone was saying, oh, Yahweh knows what he's doing. And Jung says, wait a minute. He broke four of his own commandments. How could he know what he's doing? So this work on withdrawing projections is Jung's way of bringing the feeling function back into the way we live.
And Anne's distinction of what Carol's research, that one you start, there's two different kinds, and one you start with a problem you're already going to solve.
Yeah.
And the other one you start out with a blank page and just explore it. The feeling function in the first one, where you're solving the problem, unless that's incorporated at that very front, up front stick. Is that what you're trying
to... I think the image guides the research that is not as directed, where I think the thinking function probably...
In power. That's a very helpful distinction, I think. Yeah. Because where there's an agenda, let's make a drug to get rid of psychosis, then that feeling function goes out the window. Because that feeling function means you have to slow things down.
Would it be all being a little too harsh, though? I mean, could there not be a feeling function wanting to come up with the drugs to do that? And then also, the people who are working on the molecule, aren't they still just, you know, having their images and... I mean, they're really trying to figure out how to get somewhere, but the process of still getting images and you know, following intuition and all that.
If they would, sure. And I don't think it has to be an either or, but it is an either or now.
Well, I think that you have to have both. I don't think you can not have that type of research. But if you only have that type of research, and the issue is the way research gets funded, you tend to have a lot more of that type of research, because open-ended research is your more basic research, which is what allows for that. You can't guarantee a result, and so it's hard to get funding for it.
That's almost one of a societal value of, you know, a rational
sentence. Which, in a way, is one of the implications of this work, that because we have cut off that feeling function, that is the nature of our society. I mean, this is one of the problems of understanding this stuff, is its implications are so vast, and in a way, not practical. You might say, well, how is that ever going to happen? I don't know, but what she's looking at is the epistemological basis of things, and then she's sort of saying, well, you guys worry about it from here. But I think the basic argument is sound. Okay. Now, that's a lot of the meat of the chapter. we'll come back to it, but she then starts on another couple of sections, which I don't think we need to go into quite as closely, unless they happen to grip you. But what she does now for a couple of sections is look at images in the history of culture which have been the basis of scientific theories. And I think one of the things that is a little hard to grasp here is it sounds like such common sense, or it sounds so obvious until you really think about it. For example, she's going to be talking about one of the prime, I'll read the first sentence here on page 57. One primordial image in particular has survived in scientific tradition for a greater length of time than most, and that is the visual image of God as a sphere. Now you might say, well, sure. What else? What else would the planetary orbits be? And you might say, what else would the rings of electrons around a nucleus be? But we know now that electrons don't work as rings around a nucleus. They are fields of probability. So you can see there's a case where that old image came up and grabbed the scientist's mind and shaped a theory which is kind of okay, but also not completely adequate to describing subatomic processes. So what she does now is say, one image which has run through science as an aspect of scientific theory really started as a religious idea. And that's the circle. I don't know if we need to go into all the examples.
I like this phrase, endospectic reality.
Where is that?
Third line up on that first paragraph. Yeah. Fourth line up.
Fourth line up from the end of the first paragraph?
The end of the first paragraph, sorry.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's the opposite of
trans-like.
Yes.
Oh, Lord. Won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?
Erase that.
The question that keeps coming up in my mind, only because it came up when I was doing the looking at the complexity theory stuff, is does the image and the way we look at things, is it just a change in how we're seeing it, or is the object itself changing?
Keep going.
Well, one of the things that I brought some stuff on complexity theory that we had discussed, and one of the things that the professor in this series brings up is the world is becoming more complex. He said that makes sense in, like, the marketplace. There is more interaction between, because there are more people, there's more interaction, and you can see economics as an evolving system, but it's harder to see. Would, like, a biological system, the ecosystem, that should be pretty well set. It shouldn't be evolving. But as we move into areas where wildlife used to be, more and more people and more species are put onto smaller areas of land, actually even ecology is getting more complex. So the question came up in my mind is, it's not just like now we know more about the atom than we used to, or are things actually changing as our atoms?
I would say we are reaching a level of consciousness that's able to perceive the complexity.
But what he's saying is, and in addition to that, the complexity is increasing. It actually increases the more interdependence our world
mm-hmm. has. That may be. But I would say that our mind is, you might even say synchronistically, evolving with categories of understanding to do justice to that shift in the outer world.
So it's not necessarily an either or.
Maybe not, yeah. That's a good question, though.
Just to make things a little more complex in here.
Yeah. Well, this is complex Saturday.
Well, I think that, I mean...
Well, I did want to honor your endopsychic question, if you felt like it.
Well, let's evaluate that. No.
Well, I think it just means from the inside. That, we normally think, well, science is objective. It sees, it forms theories based on fact. And what Pauli and von Franz are saying is those theories conform to certain paradigms, which we can find throughout history. So something in us shapes those facts into theories.
But then when we're looking at endopsychic, if we're asking the question of, is the world becoming more complex, is it also extra-psychic?
I think you have to say it is. Yeah, I think you have to say it is.
Yeah, because I was going to say, if you said science is based on facts, well, now we're questioning what is a fact. Because it's mm-hmm. because even that is evolving. Well, like, you know, what you were saying, the animals, they've done studies because we're taking away their land and their territory and their feeding opportunities. So their behavior is changing. They theorize, observing these, their minds are changing, their behavior is changing because they have to survive with fewer resources. And
they're acting with more speed.
And interacting. So if that's happening at that level, it's happening at our, the human level.
You mean in our mind it's happening?
Yeah.
I think so. Just take something we'll be looking at. Just take the quantum idea of complementarity. We know that electrons sometimes behave as particles and sometimes behave as waves. And you can never say, an electron is a particle or an electron is a wave. It's both. So holding contradiction as the fundamental character of reality, that's an enormously new capacity of human beings. John Wayne certainly couldn't do that. Doris Day couldn't do that. It was either good or bad. But now we're faced with living with truths that 50 years ago would have been heresies. So I think there's an idea where the mind has developed along with the challenges that have come to it.
Sort of like the gene is changing. DNA.
Yeah, and you see that show on PBS of, I forget what it was called, but within five generations, when they took a fox and tamed it, its head started to take the morphology of a dog, just in a few generations. So there's if there's a physiological change in that fox, certainly there's a mental change in that fox. In fact, they then took foxes they had raised with, had tamed, and were pets, or was it? No, they had taken dogs, and they had taken wolves that they had tamed as house pets. And within a couple of generations, they could show a baby wolf from such a mom, or a baby wolf now pet, and a baby wolf from a wild wolf reacted totally differently to human beings. So that's a mental shift in just a few generations. So I think that's a very valid point.
And a very difficult time working with those wild
wolves. But they could not work with wild wolves.
Yeah. They couldn't get them to be tamed.
They couldn't get them to bond, or they could get the tamed wolves to bond.
This is kind of irrelevant. On my way here on college, I passed either a coyote or a fox that somebody had run with. You know, here in Waterfall. I didn't know they were
there. Yeah, there's a fox living in my yard.
Is there really?
Yeah, there's foxes in our neighborhood.
The coyotes are all over in Indianapolis.
Those two.
They kill pets all the time.
But the foxes are beautiful.
Mm-hmm. They are magnificent.
Red. Mm-hmm. It's just gorgeous. Those big long tails. Just small.
I think part of that discussion in that PBS special, if I remember it correctly, was a discussion of Darwin and... Darwin's theory of evolution was much slower, and they're trying to decide whether evolution is actually speeding up, or if Darwin was wrong at the time, or if he was right at the time, but now things have changed.
Well, I think natural selection can work really rapidly, but like one generation it can go that way, and the next generation it can go that way. So over time, the trend may be not so big, but in the moment it can, So I think that's the difference between that natural selection when it's working in the moment versus the trend that you see over time. Changes can be evened out. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have to tell you a fox story. Nothing to do with projection recollection. When I was in Zurich, I had a dream that a fox would be my guide. And I lived up above Kuznacht, right next to the woods. In the evening, I'd go for a jog down kind of a country road, and then went into a farmer's lane to the gate. I'll be damned, the next night I start to jog and I hear rustle, rustle, rustle. A fox peeks out. That fox followed me the whole way down to the end of the lane and followed me back. At the end of the run, he peeked his head out. And that went on for about a week and a half. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I have sympathy for your fox. He's our patron saint. You know, he's Mercurius.
That's
isn't that weird?
Yeah.
At first I was afraid because they did have some rabies around, but he knew what he was doing. Okay, back to misery. what I thought we could do, rather than go into all the different examples she gives from myth, is take one. And that's the reference to Kepler on page 58. Now, last paragraph. I'm going to go to Pali because I think he does it a little more fully. Let me read you what Kepler himself said about the planets. If I can find it here. Page 203. Oh, it's page 205. This is Pauli quoting Kepler. Kepler says, "The image of..." I'll read this a couple times because it's...
No, this is Kepler.
This is Kepler. Okay. "The image of the triune God," Trinitarian, "the image of the triune God is in the spherical surface. That is to say, the Father is in the center, the Son is in the outer surface, and the Holy Ghost is the equality of the relation between point and circumference." Mm. Now that's a physicist talking, an astronomer.
Maybe so what was the surface?
Let me put it up here because it's so dense.
Not the sun.
The sun.
Thank you.
stood underneath your book? Or not?
Probably. Yes, thank you. So I'm going to, he says a point. I'm going to make it a little circle, for the center of the circle. And then, so this would be a planet for him, of any round body. And the nature of the round body is that that's the Father, and that's the Son, and the Holy Ghost is the fact that both of them are circular, and they stand in a parallel relationship to each other.
Would you say that again?
This is a little, I'm trying to make a little more sense. This is actually a point. But a point is a circle that's infinitely small. Mm-hmm. So that's why I just drew it into a little circle. That for him, let me get the word exactly right. In a, did I say one word? There is an analogy between the reality of God for him and the physical dimensions of a sphere. The reason a sphere is a sphere is because it reflects the nature of God, such that the God the Father is the center of the sphere, and the Son is the outer circumference of the sphere, and the Holy Ghost is the relationship. It as the center emanates out to the periphery. Now, he's not saying this is a metaphor for God. He's saying this is an image of God. And that's why a sphere is a sphere. See, it's a mythological mind. And then that gave him the impetus to investigate the laws of movement of one planet around the sun. So for him, he was investigating the nature of God. There you can see how an image shapes the scientific thinking.
Although, ironically, the sun is the father of him in the universe.
Is the...
Well, not just being facetious. You know, because we revolve around the sun. I was just thinking of...
I thought you were making a profound point.
Oh, well, they're often the same, you know.
Because it's a trinity.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's the Trinitarian mind at work. There's no quaternity there. Mm-hmm. Where's Mary? Where's Sophia? Nowhere. But the reason Pauli brings that up is to say, you know, a very respected scientist who really founded our view of the rotation of the Earth and the orbits and so on, saw that universe, the proportions of the universe were such because they were the proportions of God.
Of the God image of the time.
Well, yes, we would say for the God image of the time, he believed it. And that's what Pauli's trying to get at. It wasn't, oh, this is a metaphor. Uh-uh. He lived in this reality.
So we could say that he had a feeling relationship with
the Absolutely.
Thing he proposed.
Yeah, right.
And that grew out of his religious belief. I don't know what his religious belief was.
Yeah, I mean, at that time he was what? Was it 16th century? Early 17th century. Yeah, I mean, everybody would have been contained in the church.
In the West.
Yeah, in the West.
At least he had the Holy Spirit as the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, between the Son and the Father, the relationship was there, whereas in the usual Christian Trinity, they're just separate entities, and the relationship really isn't inferred.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, Pentecost maybe would be closest as we get to there being a continued relationship.
Yeah.
But the point for her discussion, this is what she does. I just felt her citing Kepler was a little less clear than his citing of Kepler. How that rational scientific inquiry into mathematical periods and movements had an image. And we can see that clearly. And yet we would say, no, our science is objective. And what he's saying is, no, science is objective. Each science is shaped by an image of the time. As Kepler couldn't see it because he was contained in God, we can't see it because we're contained in the image which is shaping science. But he's trying to argue for the subjective origin of scientific work.
Today it seems like scientists believe that objectivity is actually a possibility, but maybe it isn't.
Well, up to quantum mechanics, and I think that's where then Pauli would say, we quantum physicists are reshaping the paradigm, as we'll see in, as we go along, whether you see the electron as a particle or a wave depends on how you look at it. I'm being simplistic, but so that he would say what we have done is reintroduce subjectivity into science. In a very limited way, and what he's doing with the image is a much broader attempt to see the subjective origin of so-called objectivity. But I think he would say, you know, whoopee for us, because we can also acknowledge it scientifically.
So did the Pauli effect happen before he said these things?
I think it happened his whole life.
For just his whole life.
Yeah. Okay. You know about the Pauli effect? Yeah.
Okay.
Well, whenever you get near a lab, things will blow up.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, it's absolutely true.
Even going through a town or a train, and they were having an experiment, it would go and get it all messed up.
Yeah, I think some apparatus blew up. And,
yeah.
He was a theoretical physicist, and they did their best to keep him out. Okay, we've worked hard. Let's take a break. Oh, yes. All right, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted your help with one thing. The last sentence on 58. She then talks about that same spirit in terms of the human spirit, but I'm having trouble seeing it. Can you help me with that?
Oh, well,
second blade or that duality or that analogy becomes important.
The spirit is just this inner capacity of the psyche to guide itself. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All the Holy Spirit is, in Jung's view, is just a whoopee version of that.
So the sound would be the divine spirit. The surface would be the physical world, and the human and the spirit would be...
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.